The Spectator podcast is brought to you by Berry Brothers and Rudd.
Hello and welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast, and on this week's episode, we'll be discussing what a Macron presidency might look like. We'll also be talking about whether Tim Farron made a mistake by bringing God into politics. And finally, we'll be looking at how Theresa May might be about to change the Conservative Party. First up, the French election. After the first round of voting, the runoff is now between Emmanuel Macron and Marine Le Pen, and it seems as if Macron is the most likely winner. But as Jonathan Femby says in this week's cover story in The Spectator, France's new young emperor is marching towards disaster. Jonathan joins me now, along with the journalist Anne-Elisabeth Moutet. So Jonathan, in your piece, you begin with this recent story about Macron and his response in the first few days after his success. What happened?
Well, he was at a brasserie in Montparnasse, which I've been to a number of times. They have a very nice steak tartare, I must say, indeed. And he came out, and there were journalists outside. They weren't allowed in. And it was a kind of celebration for the first round victory. And some people wonder whether he should have been celebrating, because he seemed to be celebrating victory as a whole. And his speech at the end of the first round was very much, you know, as if he'd won the whole thing. But he came out, and he told the press, basically, you know, I'm just giving dinner for, it was ham and asparagus with red wine, if you in case you want to know. And I'm giving a thank you dinner for my secretaries and security guards and people who've helped me, like that. And then journalists asked him some questions, and he said, well, if you don't understand what I'm doing, you don't understand anything. I've had enough of this kind of, it's not exact translation, but it's the kind of small Parisian circle, like the chattering classes, I think, the petit milieu parisien. You can interpret it different ways. But so, and you get lost. But actually, as if he was just, you know, rewarding his workers. But in fact, sitting back there on the red plush banquette in the brasserie were figures from the past. Jacques Attali, who dates back to being an advisor to François Mitterrand in 1981. Daniel Cohn-Bendit, who you remember from the 68 riots and whose recent cycled himself as a kind of all-purpose commentator, and
he's very good on football.
He's very good on football, and so on, and there, and various other people, including, you know, really a senator who's one of the big power brokers and has been behind Macron on this, a fashionable actor, a radio commentator who is in love with the British royal family for some reason, and the old singer Line Renaud, who is now 88 years old, which was rather surprising. So, you know, it was rather a contrast between, he was saying, you know, I'm not going to reply to this Parisian establishment, elite mafia, but they're sitting back in the back, all was certainly a kind of establishment there. And that leads on, throughout to him, because he's the insurgent who actually is the perfect incarnation of the establishment.
So, Anne-Elisabeth, do you think it's fair to say that he's just more of the same?
Yes, he is. Well, I mean, he's actually, I wrote about him in yesterday's Telegraph, in which I said that he is not so much Hollande as he is Chirac. He is a young man of the bourgeoisie, come from the provinces, but with a bit of help. And he doesn't have really strong beliefs, but he expresses his not very strong beliefs in a very forceful way. And he's enamored, of course, because he is in his late 30s, enamored of technology and new technology and a kind of modern France that he is like all those French people who tell you, oh, I'm going to do this à l'américaine. And they do not do this à l'américaine at all. They do this like French sort of signs of the educated ruling class who go and look at America and say, oh, this is absolutely dandy, and come back and say, this is à l'américaine, and it's not. But, I mean, he's a bright young man. He ran an absolutely excellent campaign. I love the scene that Jonathan is evoking, because it immediately gave rise to comparisons with the victory dinner that Nicolas Sarkozy was unclever enough to have at Le Fouquet's, a brasserie which has about the same prices as La Rotonde, but on the right bank, and with more or less the same crowd, i.e. people who'd supported him. And Sarkozy could never live down the dinner at Le Fouquet's in 2007 when he was elected. It was supposed to be blingy, it was supposed to be showy, it was vulgar, it was you name it. And there's a wonderful, the cover of Libération today is a picture of Macron in front of La Rotonde, sort of raising his hands to this sort of a slightly semi-Gaullist, semi-crucifixion attitude he likes. And the headline is wonderful. It says, Manu, descend. And that means, you know, time to climb down, Emmanuel. And that's more or less what's going on. We'll see. I mean, he's clever. He's a technocrat. He has not ever run for anything, not even class president at school. He is also his first love was the theatre. He fell in love in many ways. He fell in love with his letters, French and Latin teacher, who also was in charge of the drama club. And I've been told by people who were with him at INA that he has an entourage. And I said, well, all politicians have an entourage. And they said, no, he's got an entourage like an actor. That's entirely different. So he's going, you know, possibly you need the acting more than you need the technocratic schools, the French equivalent of PPE, to rule France. But this is somebody who's never had a failure in his life except not managing to get into a second top school, École Normale Supérieure, and that's supposed to be trauma. People tell you, no, he had failures in his life. He could not get into Normale. So, yeah, it's going to be interesting to watch, but it's basically going to be Jacques Chirac dressed up as Barack Obama.
On the Spectator's cover this week, we've actually depicted him completely undressed, what as the Emperor's new clothes, which I don't know how that's going to go down. But Jonathan, what do you think a Macron presidency would actually look like if he does get it?
Well, the difficulty is that, you know, this is the important election, the presidential election, but then we have another election, which will come in June, which is the parliamentary election. And in France, for a president to rule, that president has to have a government which has the support of a majority in parliament. And Macron has precisely no members of parliament at the moment. It must be said Le Pen only has two. You can see a coalition coming together behind Macron of disappointed socialists who did terribly badly in the election, the kind of social democrat wing, Manuel Valls, the former prime minister, and others. Some have already gone behind Macron. The centrists and, let us say, some liberal people on the mainstream right. But whether this would be enough to constitute a majority for a government is a really big question. That's where why I say he's heading for big trouble, I think. And if you take both the what remains of the Socialist Party and the Republicans, who are the mainstream right party, for them, having been, in the Socialist case, only got 6% of the vote in the first round, and in the Republicans, who should have won the election with their eyes closed there, but they managed to lose it with François Fillon and all the scandals around him and a pretty divided and not very good campaign. Both those parties are now kind of fighting to restore their own fortunes. And if they go in with Macron in a coalition led by him, the danger is that he starts to eat them up alive, and that then for the Republicans, particularly if their liberal wing goes to Macron, the right-wingers in the Republicans say, well, let's line up with Le Pen next time round.
Well, we have people lying in wait for precisely this kind of problem. And of course, the biggest beast lying in wait is Nicolas Sarkozy. Yeah. Nicolas Sarkozy has predicted the defeat of François Fillon for about 2 weeks. He's been quite open about this. And people said, oh, he wants to be a prime minister de cohabitation. That cohabitation has got to be explained. It started under Mitterrand when Mitterrand lost the 1986 legislative elections, which at the time were not contiguous with the presidential election. And so he had to take a conservative prime minister, and that was Jacques Chirac. And I would say that overall, even though Chirac seemed to have everything in hand, Mitterrand ran circles around him.
Yeah, he did, absolutely.
And we both remember that. So that's Sarkozy thinks he actually can run circles around Macron. It's not impossible, and he could be. But could he be a prime minister of cohabitation? That was the feeling about 2-3 weeks ago. Right now, he says it's going to be a lot more difficult because the feeling of failure is going to sort of stick to the soles of the shoes of the Républicains for a bit. Yeah. And so he says, first of all, get the MPs, reorganize the party. The Republican Party, the several times renamed Gaullist Party, which is no longer Gaullist and has at least five names that I can think of, UMP, UDR, APR, etc. That is a party that, like the Socialist Party, has not been able to reinvent itself. The Socialists were killed by the man who had sort of kept them artificially alive, François Hollande, who used to be their first secretary and therefore the leader. And the Républicains are now going to be sort of killed off exactly by what Jonathan described, which is this opposition between a hard right and moderate right. And of course, you have the trap, which was invented by François Mitterrand when he gave a lease of life to Jean-Marie Le Pen's Front National to begin with. And that's, how do you split the right? You split it by creating a neo-fascist party, and he did this by having enough proportional voting within the system for just a bit, and that coincided with European elections, so that suddenly they existed, and that was the long rise of the Front National, and that meant that the votes of the right were split. This is probably what Macron is clever enough to do, and if he doesn't do it, there are enough people who were actually with Attali the first time round, with Mitterrand the first time round, and they include Jacques Attali, who will do this for him. Meanwhile, the Socialist Party, I think the Socialist Party is going to be reinvented by Macron outside the Socialist Party. And it will be, you know, En Marche will change its name after a bit, and it will be what Tony Blair did for Labour without changing its name, and it would be what the Germans have done by just having a democratic congress at Erfurt in the in the 70s.
Let's just talk about Marine Le Pen briefly.
Yes,
the last few years have been defined by huge political upset. Do you think there's any chance that we could have President Le Pen?
I will just say no. And we'll meet again next month and see.
I think it's a very, 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 very small chance. I don't like to dismiss things entirely. If, you know, instead of shooting one poor cop, somebody comes to the Champs-Élysées, some other place in Paris, and sprays bullet around and kills 80 people, as at the time of Bataclan. And if she runs a better campaign than she did in the first round, because that was actually a bad campaign that she ran. But I have seen, you know, the first appearances that she's just made. Boy, she was excellent, because she was egged on by failure. She's decided she's no longer Front National. She says, I'm an independent. She's taking a leaf from the Macron sketchbook. So I will say, you know, 90% Macron is president, and 10%. 10% we could have Marine.
No, it's possible. I mean, you've always been able to see her potential route to the Élysée, which is where I've never thought she was going to win. But that was the big change with this election, because in the past you couldn't see how.
Is there still a potential route now?
Well, the potential is a very low turnout at the second round, a transfer of Republican Fillon voters on the right to her.
And Dupont-Aignan.
And Dupont,
the 5%
who
of the
did
vote
quite well with 5%.
Basically killed off the Fillon, Fillon
plus
place.
The left. In right across the left, saying we Macron's a free market liberal, blah, blah, we don't want him, he's a banker, you know, we're not going to vote for a banker, and them staying away in masses, which if there was, say, a big terrorist attack, you could see all this being amplified, and that is quite possible for her. But I think what was just being said is absolutely true. We forget that her campaign really wasn't good at all. She started the year with 28% in the polls. She ended up with 21%. Mélenchon came up, as it were, on the left as the repository for angry voters, for disappointed voters. So there was somewhere else to go to.
He's gone, will they be voting Le Pen?
Well, no, I mean, the polls...
Some of them.
From polls, some, about 25%, it said, and about 50% go for Macron, 25%
In the countryside, they will vote for her.
Yeah.
In the cities, they will vote for Macron, and in the countryside, because it's really... It's as sharply divided as the Brexit vote.
Yeah.
And these are... The question is... Is there such a thing as a populist wave, you know, sweeping Europe, or was that just a sort of simple idea but does not exist? Because the British vote was a very British vote, but the Dutch voted like the Dutch, the French have voted like the French, and European nation states actually have personalities. It's not, you know, it's not one place. But if there is any kind of resurgence of that, the reasons, you know, the anger, the feeling of being dispossessed, the feeling of sort of going down in the world, and that you are being talked down to by smart people in expensive suits in the capital, then we will see Trump voter and Brexit voter reappear, and they would vote for Marine.
Because 47% of people voted for the outsider parties, if you like, in this. Although whether the National Front is really completely an outsider party, you can argue about now. They've been around for a very long time indeed. Now, if you take off, say, 7-10% of that as being just people who were having a bit of fun on the first round and so on, you've still got up to 40% outside the system. Now, again, in the parliamentary elections, those people, those parties will get very few seats indeed. So the potential for action outside Parliament and protest against the Macron presidency is very high, I think. And you'd have Macron trying to hold together a coalition, because he's not going to get enough seats for En Marche, so you're going to have to make a coalition all the time. This, he may spend all his time trying to do the carpentry of coalition rather than actually changing anything. And then you've got Le Pen, who, interestingly, as you're saying, I mean, as from Monday night, her line was interviewed on television just after the first round, the Monday night, was, yes, you know, people were saying the fear factor works against you and so on and so on. And she was saying, yes, I know, but am I really so frightening and so on and so on? The really frightening person is Emmanuel Macron. He looks very nice. He looks very smooth. He's smiling very nicely, but he is the dangerous man. He's going to destroy your jobs. He's going to destroy your social security system. He's going to open you up to globalization, finance, et cetera, et cetera.
He's going to destroy the country, the soul of the country, because the view of Macron is he's one of those people who live at the French, a nice expression, they say hors sol, you know, he's above the ground. He can travel, he speaks languages, he believes in money that travels, he wants to tax property, for instance. He has said that was not such a clever thing to do. There is no such thing as French culture, meaning the French culture is an aggregate of many other cultures. But all of this is resented by people who feel that their identity is being taken away from them.
And he, of course, said, you know, French imperialism had been a crime, the French Empire had been a crime. All these things which, yes, you know what he meant when he said it, but in Le Pen's mouth, this is quite potent stuff. So we've got an interesting 10 days to go.
That was Jonathan Femby and Anne-Elisabeth Moutet.
If you've always wanted to start a wine cellar, 2017 could be the perfect time. Barry Brothers and Rudd's cellar plan is designed to suit all tastes and budgets. To find out more, visit bbr.com/cellarplan.
In this week's issue, Theo Hobson says that Theresa May's soft Christian message could help win her the election. A British politician mildly affirming our main religious tradition is no bad thing, he says. And in fact, it just goes to show that chippy secularism is a minority taste. Yet Tim Farron has also discovered that a liberal politician can't afford to be seen as doctrinally conservative. I'm now joined by Damien Thompson and Nick Spencer, Research Director at Theos and the editor of The Mighty and the Almighty, to discuss the role that religion will play in this year's election. So, Damien, it seems striking that Theresa May's religious position has gone down quite differently to Tim Farron's. Why do you think that is?
I think one reason is that Theresa May does religion with far greater skill than Tim Farron does. In other words, she does it in private, whereas he made rather a thing of being an evangelical Christian, at which point people said to him, well, do you subscribe to evangelical Christian teaching on homosexuality? And he said, yes, and then he said, sort of, and now he's in a mess because he's not terribly good at talking himself out of these tight spots. Essentially, as far as I can work out, he's got very, very mildly conservative, middle-of-the-road views on homosexuality, which are, like many Liberal Democrat views, open to negotiation.
Nick, do you think it's fair that Tim Farron's being questioned on this avenue for the election?
It seems to have been a bit of a witch hunt in the last week or so. It's because these are Liberal Democrats, of course. I don't think many other politicians would have had quite the same scrutiny. I think some Liberals feel he's guilty of a kind of thought crime and they want to hunt him out for that. It's also because I think, going back to the original question, Theresa May, like Gordon Brown in a different way, both cradle Christians. Tim Farron, I think, was baptised as an adult, and I think we have a greater interest in those politicians who found God later on in life. One of the reasons why we were so fascinated by Blair's religion too.
I suppose one of the criticisms is that no other religion would ever be asked these questions. I mean, Sadiq Khan presumably wouldn't be asked for his views on homosexuality.
So I mean, you can't imagine Cathy Newman of Channel 4 going after a Muslim politician who is likely to have, indeed is probably required to have, far, far stricter views on homosexuality than Tim Farron ever does. And we might also point out the hypocrisy that left-wing Labour is very friendly with people who hang homosexuals from cranes. Having said that, I've got no sympathy for Tim Farron at all, because the Lib Dems are such an opportunistic little party. He's so keen to, like all Liberal Democrat leaders, to score a cheap point. You hear him talk about Boris as Trump's poodle the other day. I just thought, this is a typical Lib Dem for you, so sorry, this is my particular angle, but it couldn't happen to a nicer party.
Do you think it's going to affect, I mean, people are predicting the Lib Dems will get far more seats. Do you think this could actually affect the number of seats that they
Not
get?
Not at all. Not at all, because I just don't think religion plays a part in people's voting preferences these days, unless you're Muslim.
It's interesting you say that, though, because Theo, in his piece, suggests that secularism is a minority position in Britain. Do you think that's fair?
Doctrinaire secularism is. I mean, secularism, a bit like religion, have been said a bit like they're like swimming pools, really. All the noise is at the shallow end. And you have some very vocal secularists who like to imagine that their particular muscular secularism is typical of the British population. It isn't. We're not particularly religious. We're not motivated by religion when it comes to voting. But the idea that we're motivated by some kind of British equivalent of laïcité is also wrong.
That's absolutely spot on. I mean, actually, the idea that the British were ever tremendously religious, or I mean, there's never been a mega religious revival in Britain. Look at attendance at church during the Victorian era. It wasn't really much higher than it was 100 years later.
Famously, the 1851 census showed that half of the population of the country wasn't in church at the time, and only half of those that were in church were in an Anglican church. This was at the beginning of what was the biggest ecclesiastical arms race we've ever had in this country, with a church being opened every other day in the last 50 years of Victoria's reign, until by the end of the Victoria's reign, an awful lot of churchmen looked over their shoulders and actually looked at empty pews. This is the end of the Victorian period. So you're right, there was a significant revival in the early years of the 19th century, which shaped Victorian Britain culture very significantly. But to imagine we've gone from a age in which everyone attended church and everyone decided their daily lives according to their theological positions to where we are today is wrong.
We obviously have a Prime Minister who's a vicar's daughter. Do you think Theresa May is trying to kind of revive a sort of gentle religious voting position?
It's very difficult to work out exactly what she's trying to do. We do know that she's a regular churchgoer. I think it's interesting that her husband is a server in their local church, which implies to me a greater commitment to regular church going than we've seen from any Prime Minister for a long time. I never knew what to make of Blair's religion, by the way. It was rather mysterious. He didn't quite discover it later in life, but he did become a Catholic later in life, though he's never shown the slightest interest in the teachings of the Catholic Church. Let's go back to this point about secularisation. I've often thought that the essence of secularisation is not so much that militant secularists are trying to eradicate religion, the laïcité of France, rather that the churches are secularising to the point where it's difficult to distinguish them from aid agencies.
Well, the point is there are different kinds of secularism, really. Rowan Williams helpfully pulled apart programmatic and procedural secularism. In actual fact, I think the whole Tim Farron issue this week is less about Christianity and more about liberalism. There is a kind of modus vivendi liberalism, which is reasonably happy for people to live their own lives, particularly inside their own head. And then there is a much more programmatic liberalism that insists that your private thought should concur entirely with your public policy and your public persona, and woe betide you if it's otherwise. Similarly with secularism, there is a kind of modus vivendi secularism, and then there's a secularism which says we keep expressions of religious faith out of the public square. One of the challenges we have in the 21st century is steering towards the right kind of liberalism, if you like, or the right kind of secularism, and away from the more aggressive, muscular, doctrinaire forms of liberalism and secularism.
In the last hour, we've just seen that the ex-MP David Ward, who was due to be standing for the Lib Dems in the Bradford seat, has been sacked from the party by Tim Farron for supposedly anti-Semitic comments. Do you think Tim Farron is sort of responding to the witch hunt which he was the victim of earlier this week?
Well, I think anti-Semitism in the Liberal Democrats is much more of a problem than homophobia in the Liberal Democrats, as we saw in the case of Baroness Tang, or however you pronounce it, who stayed in the party for many, many years despite being a vicious anti-Semite.
Do you think that's going to affect them less, though? Do you think homophobia is a bigger issue for Lib Dem voters than anti-Semitism?
It will all be very much bound up with, and when you say anti-Semitism, it's all often very, very bound up with Muslim attitudes towards the Jews, and so becomes rather complex and becomes rather tied up with local ethnic politics. But I was just wondering, who was the last British politician who was able to talk about religion in a relaxed and convincing way that actually attracted an audience?
Personally, I would have said Thatcher in the 70s. She gave two impressive lectures at St Lawrence Jewry in 77 and 78. She spoke openly about her faith. Interestingly, in her first 20 years as a parliamentarian, she was much more circumspect. She moved quite a long way from Grantham and then rediscovered it in the 1970s. So it was a little bit forced, but nonetheless, it had a candour and actually an intellectual integrity to it that is pretty much a rarity in the post-war period. She tended to avoid doing that in the 80s, and famously, when she went up to the Church of Scotland in 88, her Sermon on the Mound, as it was received very much less well and actually was not as good a speech. To my mind, Thatcher in the 70s, I would have thought.
That sounds about right to me.
Do you think it's even possible nowadays to be a politician and be religious?
I think it's very difficult to make religion absolutely central to your political philosophy and expect people to take you seriously.
Seems to be what Tim Farron has found.
I'm sorry, I can't help thinking that there's an element of let's try and make life difficult for this smug little pipsqueak. So even though the attacks on him are hypocritical, I can't get too upset about them.
That was Damien Thompson and Nick Spencer. And if you'd like to hear more from Damien on world religion, please do subscribe to his Holy Smoke podcast. Finally, on to the British election. In this week's issue, Jane Forsyth says that a landslide Tory election victory would change both the Tory party and Theresa May's premiership. James joins me now, along with Paul Goodman, the editor of Conservative Home. So James, in your piece, you suggest that the Tories' centre of gravity might be about to shift. What direction is it shifting in?
Well, I think if you look at the places where the Tories might win at this election, Wrexham, Stoke, Darlington, I think you're going to see the Tory party move right on Brexit and immigration and left on the economy and public services. And that's interestingly pretty much where Theresa May has taken the Tory party since becoming Prime Minister. I think the shift on Brexit doesn't really matter that much because it is quite clear the kind of Brexit that Theresa May is going to try and negotiate, you know, outside the single market, outside the customs union, but with a transitional period to prevent any kind of cliff edges. I think more significant is this shift on the economy and electing MPs from these kind of places, with the fact that Theresa May is, I think, the most left-wing Tory Prime Minister in 40 years on economic questions. And I think you could see quite a big Tory shift coming, a move to a much more Christian democratic style party.
In your piece, you also mentioned that the Tory spin doctors are in a bit of a flap about the prospect of Jeremy Corbyn not even seeming plausible. Is that going to be an actual problem for the Tories?
Yes, I think the Tories are determined to kind of talk up Labour's chances, because this is the thing, if there is no risk of Jeremy Corbyn becoming Prime Minister, you can vote for your local Labour candidate if you like him. Or you can think, oh, I'll vote for the Liberal Democrats because, you know, they're all right. If there's no risk of Jeremy Corbyn becoming Prime Minister, it doesn't matter that he wouldn't take out the leader of Islamic State in a drone strike. It doesn't matter that he never pressed the nuclear button. So I think what you're going to see the Tories trying to do is, even as the polls show them on 50% and Labour on 25%, they're going to say, oh, you can't know anything, don't trust the polls. They sound like spin doctors for a failing campaign because they're saying, ah, these polls. Normally when people are dismissing polls, it's because they're behind in them. They're trying to dismiss them because they're ahead in them.
Paul, the shortlist is starting to be announced. Is there a sense that the Tories are looking for a certain type of candidate?
It's not clear yet whether or not there's a definite down on Leave people who supported Brexit. There's some indications to that effect. So, for example, in Aldershot, we wrote on Conservative Home last weekend that the association wants Daniel Hannan, who's one of the most prominent Eurosceptic figures in the country in political circles, and that's apparently been blocked. On the other hand, there are some levers elsewhere, so there may be a particular issue there we don't know about. But on the whole, you know, I would expect most of these candidates, when the dust clears, remember, they've only selected a small portion of them so far, to be rather in Theresa May's image. They'll be very pragmatic people. They will be loyalists, as Tory candidates tend to be. I suspect when you prod and poke around the old internet files or leaflets, you'll find most of them supported Remain, but now I've decided the only practical course is to back Theresa May and vote Leave. You know, we will see. But when that happens, I think we'll get a parliamentary party like that. I think an interesting question that arises from James's piece is, will it be true that the further north you go, the less free market orientated, on the whole, the candidates will be, and the more kind of socially conservative in a quiet way they will be? I don't think we'll know the answer to that yet until we see the candidates.
As Paul says, look, you won't know the answer until you see the candidates. There'll be kind of structural forces in play, which we already see it in the Commons now, which is, if you are the MP for one of these places, you want regional growth fund money. You want the industrial strategy to benefit your area. So I think you'll see all of those things coming through. I mean, to put it crudely, I think the more of a nation that the Tory party represents, the more one nation it will be, simply by nature of trying to hold on to these seats against Labour.
James, you also suggest in your piece that, like you said before, it's not all about Brexit and that Theresa May wants to put her stamp on other policies. What other things will she be looking at?
Well, I think the most interesting question is on the economy. Because we know that Theresa May has tried to do certain things and her cabinet said, oh, I think that's a little bit interventionist, Prime Minister. And she has retreated. When she has won her own personal mandate, and this is going to be a personal mandate, you know, you look at the latest poll today, it says 61% of people think she would make the best Prime Minister. This is going to be a kind of ringing endorsement of her personally. And you know, even Tories who are deeply sceptical of her report, but she is just incredibly popular on the doorstep. So I think you will then see her trying to push forward her own version of conservatism, which is in some ways a kind of bridge. You know, the important thing to remember about Theresa May is she joined the Tory party before Margaret Thatcher became leader. She is not a kind of free market libertarian. And I think you will see her trying to push her own less red in tooth and claw version of capitalism after this election.
Picking this up, the period since she became leader has been a very interesting one, in that she arrived with a very clear body of interventionist ideas that she'd worked on with her co-chief of staff, Nick Timothy. And this is an unusual government in some ways. It's very interventionist, but there's also a lot of cabinet discussion in committees. And the Chancellor of the Exchequer, who was a more powerful figure before the budget than he is now, together with other ministers who supported his free market point of view, Sajid Javid, Michael Fallon and others, did a pretty good job of fighting off some of these interventionist ideas, like putting workers on boards. So it'll be very interesting to see if Nick Timothy can smuggle some of this stuff back into the manifesto, thereby giving it an authority that it didn't have when Theresa May came in, took over from David Cameron on his manifesto.
With regards to the manifesto, the Tories are obviously trying to appeal to both a UKIP voter and also a Labour voter. How are they going to do that?
The polarity for them is appealing on the one hand to the kinds of voters they are making inroads into, who are former Labour voters, former UKIP voters, people who on the whole have tended not to vote in Midlands and Yorkshire and Northern marginals. They need them, that's where they're doing well. The problem they've got is with fired up, Remain type, Liberal Democrat flavoured voters on the southwest of London, in the southwest of England generally, and scattered throughout bits of the south like Bath. They've got an issue with them. That's why I think last week she repeated the pledge to spend 0.7% of GDP on overseas aid, because it matters to that type of voter, and she'll want to have something to balance her manifesto out so she doesn't lose that type of voter and that type of seat, at the same time as she's gaining, you know, Newcastle under Lyme, as she's hoped, another seat the Conservatives haven't won since early in the century, or Bishop Auckland.
James, the spin doctors might be worried, but it's looking likely that it might be a Tory landslide. Do you think there's any way that Labour can recover from that?
No, because I think that their mouthpiece in this election has to be Jeremy Corbyn. He is their champion, and Jeremy Corbyn, I think, is determined in this election not to hide his views on foreign policy and national security from the public. And while the public might well agree with him about not intervening in the Iraq war, I don't think they agree with him about not taking out the leader of Islamic State in a drone strike if you had the opportunity to do so, or having a nuclear deterrent but stating publicly that you would never use it. I think Corbyn is just a kind of ball and chain around Labour. I think he makes it very, very hard for them to make any progress in this election. Indeed, they're going to go backwards. I mean, one of the things that I'm struck by is how regional Labour parties are already pulling resources out of Labour-held seats in an attempt to hold on to some seats in the region. I mean, I think this must be unprecedented for an opposition party to be doing this before the formal campaign has even got underway. So I do struggle to see how Labour come back. And as for Theresa May, watch where she goes, not what she says. She's already visited Labour-held seats in London, the West Midlands, the North West and Wales. That all indicates to me that the Tories actually think the polls are not that inaccurate.
Just finally, Paul, James in his piece mentions this idea of a One Nation party. Do you think a One Nation party is a good thing?
So David Cameron led what he saw as being a One Nation party, and he used the rhetoric of One Nation a lot. But it had a kind of different flavour or taste or smell. It had much more of David Cameron's home counties flavoured, rather moderate, rather metropolitan-tinged appeal about it. Theresa May really is a kind of different kettle of fish, being brought up in a kind of public service background as a vicar's daughter and being assisted in Downing Street by Nick Timothy and co, who see themselves as being, and I think to some extent are, kind of much more rougher-hewn street fighters. So she's going after this as a different kind of One Nation conservatism. It's much more interventionist, as James says. It's got a much more patriotic flavour because it's now associated with Brexit. And in some ways, got a certain sort of Victorian or Edwardian feel to it, very different from the kind of One Nation that Cameron was trying to project. So the question, in a way, isn't, is she a One Nation politician or not? It's kind of, what kind of One Nation is she hoping to deliver?
That was James Forsyth and Paul Goodman. That's all for this week, but if you want to hear more election analysis, please do subscribe to our Coffeehouse Shots podcast, where we'll be releasing a new episode every day during the campaign. You can also subscribe to the podcast on the iTunes store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. And you can also subscribe to our other shows, including our books podcast, where this week Sam Leith is in conversation with performance poet Murray Lachlan Young. And if you enjoy the podcast, why not pick up the magazine? You can read all the features discussed on today's podcast, as well as great pieces by Alex Renton, Aidan Hartley and Prue Leith. And we've got a special election offer. Get 6 issues for just £6 by visiting spectator.co.uk/subscribe. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week.